Welcome, fellow survivors, to another episode of A Real Tour of Post-Apocalyptic England. I'm your host and amateur escologist, Richard Oliver. Last time I told you about our encounter with suicidal ghosts and how we were saved by stirring philosophical and spiritual arguments. It took a few days with no ghostly possessions for everyone on board to relax, confident we had left the ghost behind us. People had begun to talk that, well, England didn't feel very post-apocalyptic, more just apocalyptic. Yes, there would still be dangers in a post-apocalyptic society, but it felt like ever since our arrival, we had been beset by all manner of terrifying problems. The captain dismissed these concerns and assured us we wouldn't be here if it wasn't safe. Well, relatively safe. But still, the chatter continued, just a bit more discreetly. Of course, if we had been misled, why? Why would someone want us to travel into an apocalyptic country? We were distracted from these unsettling questions by the announcement that we were approaching a city, and everyone went into their usual preparations. For many people, this meant a lot of cleaning of, assembling of, and practicing with guns. Most of my preparation was done when I had sharpened several pencils and filled up my hip flask, but everyone has their own rituals. We were all disappointed when scouts reported that there was no large population in the city. At best, we would find some small groups of survivors trying to maintain some slapdash society. I had to admit, things were not looking positive for England. While we had only seen a small part of the country, we had hardly encountered any people. If this pattern continued across the country, then the population of England would be extremely small. I was worried that my future would not be in rebuilding our society, but becoming a museum curator of a dead civilization. What would happen if there wasn't a viable population still around? The central government authority had declared whole countries lost causes before. Would they do it to England? Perhaps to take my mind off these unhappy thoughts, I volunteered to head out into the city to see what could be found. This wasn't a supply run. Oddly enough, supplies were never a problem. Instead, we were looking for culturally valuable items. Sometimes this meant great works of art from pre-apocalypse times, or it could just be an old newspaper. There was a team of art experts, historians, and similar experts dedicated to just this work, and I headed off to train with them. A couple of episodes ago, I mentioned how it is not always the most obviously terrifying things that scare us the most, and I made the argument that something inexplicable can be more disturbing. I still believe that to be true, but this city had a lot going for it in the traditional scary ways, and I quickly began to regret my decision in heading out with the expedition. Tall buildings in various state of disrepair and decay surrounded us. Burnt out cars and walls pockmarked with gunfire. Dark red patches of what had to be blood seemed to be everywhere, marking the walls, the pavements, streetlights, everything. The streets were strewn with fallen weapons and detritus a panicked crowd leave behind when it decides to flee. The one thing that was ominously missing, dead bodies. I could see things moving at the edge of my vision, and it felt like we were being watched. My companions were also growing anxious, and I noticed several rested their hands on their weapons, ready for whatever was coming. This group of cultural experts may not sound a terribly ferocious bunch, but each of them was a mixture between Indiana Jones and Dirty Harry, people who loved art and culture and were quite happy to eliminate anyone who felt differently. It was then that we heard noise. It wasn't panicked screams or the sounds of fighting, but just a gentle hum of activity. We entered a large square where a couple of dozen people had set up a small camp. Tents were in the centre while they had arranged cars around the edges of their camp. There were no guards or walls. The cars were spaced out and offered little protection. Children were playing happily. Even as the people noticed us, they were not alarmed and wandered over to greet us. There was a friendly exchange of pleasantries between our two groups, with me and my companions puzzled at finding this small group of people who seemed completely at ease in their terrifying surroundings. Due to popular demand and against my own personal judgment, we have decided to bring back our very own Missed Connections personal ads, Hopeless Encounters. Not even my rather cynical and pessimistic title has stopped the enthusiasm the public have shown towards it, and even though I have previously said the feature was dead, people continue to submit their personal ads. So here it goes. Number one, I saw you in Venice. I was the tall woman in red on the boat who helped pull you out of the water. You were the man who nearly drowned fighting the giant squid. Call me. Number two, New York, Empire State Building. Our eyes met across a bank vault. You were the small, agile, gun-wielding woman killing my fellow clones. I thought you might have felt the same as you left me alive. Come back to where I work. And finally, number three. We saw you. You will complete our collective, and we shall attain perfection. We are coming. You were the young woman driving the pickup truck, driving away from us quickly. But no matter how far you run, we will find you. You will join us. Okay, enough of that nonsense. Back to the narrative. Annette Vaska, the leader of our cultural historians, took charge of the situation. Vaska is a serious woman who has personally retrieved 3 Picassos, a book of Van Gogh sketches, and Mickey Mantle's baseball bat, and despite being cornered by zombies, did not use said bat to defend herself. Her willowy physique and kind eyes do a good job at hiding her strength. Many people assumed it would be the big, muscle-bound Bluto types who would do well in the apocalypse, but such people are slow and awkward. Much better to be slim, nimble and quick. Vaska looked round at the camp and then asked the obvious question. What are you doing here? The camp was indefensible, even I could see that. It offered virtually no protection while it was surrounded by signs of brutal horror. What would seem to be the obvious answer, the one that had occurred to Vaska, but not to me, was that it was this group who was responsible for the brutal horror. Yes, they appeared on the surface like harmless, naive hippies, but who knew what was going on? Their answer was even more troubling. They weren't aware of any danger. Vaska had been on the verge of ordering us all back to the train when she spotted something. Slowly skulking towards the camp was a humanoid figure, dressed in tattered clothes with long limbs that were out of proportion to its body and a strange, gnarled and bumpy head. Whatever it wasn't human, at least not anymore, and the first thought that went through my head was zombie. Presumably Vaska thought something similar as she quickly raised the rifle in her hands and fired. It was a clean shot, hitting the creature in the chest and felling it. Cautious as ever, Vaska ejected the case and readied the next round, and stalked forward, keeping the rifle aimed at the creature. Vaska neared the body, stopped, and kept the rifle fixed on the creature. Satisfied it was not going to move, but not satisfied enough that it was actually dead, Vaska slung her rifle over her shoulder, drew a pistol, and fired twice into the creature's head. It might seem overkill, but some of these post-apocalyptic creatures are not easy to kill, and some people aren't satisfied unless they fed the body through a wood chipper. Vaska returned to our group and turned to the people from the camp. What was that? She asked. A number of the people all spoke at once, each saying something different, but essentially asking the same question. What was what? None of them had given any particular thought to what the creature was, why it was there, or paid any attention to Vaska killing it. Even when a perplexed Vaska took them to the body, they had no answers. But even then, when confronted with this creature, it elicited no response. One person actually seemed upset that Vaska had killed it, describing it as harmless. While sometimes appearances are deceptive, the creature did not look harmless, and the motto of the post-apocalyptic world was very much shoot first, ask questions never. Within 10 minutes, people from the camp had forgotten all about the creature and moved on to other topics. Unhappy with the strangely disinterested crowd, Vaska got directions to a nearby museum and led us on. All of us had assumed that the creature was responsible for the death and destruction of the area. But there was one problem with that. Just one creature couldn't do all this damage by itself. Everyone seemed to be clutching their weapons more tightly, whereas I squeezed my hip flask for reassurance. The museum was a disappointment. The whole place was a mess. With someone seemingly delighting in destroying and defacing the culturally invaluable, if in a practical sense, worthless items housed within. Vaska quickly realised there was nothing worth saving and gave the order to head back to the train. The look of disappointment on Vaska's face was devastating. She loved art and seeing a museum in such a state was a terrible shock to her. This time we decided to skip the camp we had passed and take a slightly longer way back to the train. We had been gone for 4 hours. You know, it takes literally forever to walk anywhere. And we could tell straight away something very bad had happened. But no one on board felt the same way. I have recently come under some criticism for my reaction to the cult we met a few weeks ago who constantly reenacted the same day. I viewed them very negatively, which might be because they tried to kill us, but regardless, I shouldn't dismiss their way of life out of hand. Some people could be very happy in that society. As such, here's a roundup of a few societies across the world that have gone rather extreme. Two new cities have been created, southwest and northeast of Sapporo in Japan. In the southeastern city, people pay zero tax, allowing their citizens the ultimate freedom from state interference and control. Whereas in the northwest city, tax is 100%, allowing their citizens every protection from a generous provider government. Economists around the world are eagerly watching both societies to see which will do better. Barcelona and the surrounding area of Spain have taken an innovative step in handling emotions. Each citizen has been fitted with a suitable emotional response chip in their brains, which inhibits all emotions except those approved by the Emotional Situation Committee. 100-person strong cross-section of society who have already started going through common scenarios and dictating the correct emotional response. For example, if someone does spill a glass of milk, the correct response is mild irritation, certainly no crying. The mastermind behind this project, Professor Valeria Comos, stated her long-term ambition is to have a standard and mandatory rulebook of emotions for every conceivable scenario. Finally, a new movement has taken over the abandoned Swedish city of Gothenburg and set up what they call the Home of the Mean, and will only allow people who fall within a small degree of averageness on important traits. They believe that society is held back by caring for the below average and is jeopardised by the recklessness of the above average. They believe that having society that is strictly average will provide the best outcome for the most people. So that's a review of some rather extreme societies that some of you may be interested in joining. And remember, whether a society is a utopia or dystopia is very much a point of view. As we headed back to the train station, the signs of trouble were numerous and explicit. The first thing we noticed was the smoke, a thick plume of black smoke rising from the direction of the train. As we neared the train station, we could see that part of the building had caught fire and was rapidly being consumed by flames, with no one trying to put it out. We approached the station walking alongside the tracks and was hardly surprised when we encountered a handful of dead creatures, identical to the creature Vasker had shot. After the dead bodies of the creatures, we found hundreds of spent bullet casings and then a few dead soldiers, killed by wide gashes into their flesh. I was panicking, my heart racing, but Vasker seemed calm and we slowly moved towards the train. As we reached the engine, there was a badly injured soldier lying on a bench, his rifle on the ground beside him. Given his silence and lack of movement, we all thought him dead, until he greeted us as we passed. "Hello," said the soldier, sounding perfectly happy despite the vicious wounds he had sustained and the vast amounts of blood he had lost. I am quite sure that had I been armed, I would have shot him in shock. Vasker shouted out simple orders that her team carried out perfectly, while I felt awkward and out of place. I half expected Vasker to give me some busy work to do, such as cleaning paintbrushes, while her competent colleagues did the actual work. Vasker and her team did what they could for the soldier, but it was clear he was dying. Not that he seemed to mind much, and then Vasker shot him a series of questions about what had happened, to which he replied with answers like, "Nothing much." Even when asked about what happened to him specifically, he was vague. It wasn't long before the soldier finally did die, in what was one of the more peaceful and dignified deaths I have ever seen. Personally, I am looking for an undignified death. I will struggle, beg, plead, and mourn to stay alive for as long as I can. Once the soldier had died, there was nothing left to do but get back on board the train. The engine was sealed and appeared to be empty, so we entered the first carriage that was open. I get a lot of correspondence about the train. How big is it? How many carriages does it have? What facilities on board? and while I try to answer as many as possible, often I simply do not know the answer. The train has a curious geography that seems to subtly shift when you're not paying attention. I tend to eat in the dining car, but there's also a restaurant car, a cafeteria, at least two coffee shops, and a number of different options available for the hungry passenger. There are a number of mysterious carriages that I do not have access to, and yet never seem to impede my travels about the train. What I'm trying to say is that describing the train is very difficult, and aside from a few crucial carriages, much of the train is liable to change. As such, none of us were too surprised to climb aboard the carriage and see we were in the one used by one of our resident physicists, young Miss Foley. The carriage was in immaculate order, everything neatly in its place, and in fact, the whole place sparkled. This was not the usual set of circumstances for Miss Foley. Normally, whatever space she occupies is a maelstrom of crumpled bits of paper and half-empty cans of fizzy pop. Miss Foley was busily scrubbing the floor of the carriage and didn't notice our arrival. Eventually, I coughed. She looked up in surprise and smiled at us. She chatted amiably about nothing in particular, but never stopped her cleaning. When we asked her about the attack on the train, the dead soldiers, the creatures outside, she didn't seem to think much about it. "I've had far more important stuff to be doing. Can't worry about that right now," she said. "I've been getting this place in order, and then I've got lots of ideas for some groundbreaking experiments." I tried to talk to her to make her understand, but nothing seemed to faze her. She was similar to the people at the camp, but where they were more docile, Foley was active. We moved through the train and everyone we met showed similar problems. Most had no recollection of the creatures, and of the few who did, they either didn't consider them a problem or found themselves too busy with trivial tasks to do anything about it. We also found several places where there were signs of a struggle. Vaska and her team examined the damage and the tracks leading away from the train and surmised that a few people on board had been taken by the creatures. Exhausted and in despair, I broke one of the few rules on board and lit a cigarette while not being in the designated smoking area. Vaska, however, wouldn't tolerate such behaviour. She knocked the cigarette from my hand and brought down her heavy boot on the cigarette and uttered, "Pull yourself together, man." I had never been one who maintained their cool in a crisis, and by my own standards, I thought I was handling it all quite well. It seemed that it was only me, Vaska and her team who remained unaffected, presumably because we hadn't been present for the attack on the train. Vaska was pacing up and down, thinking the situation through. "Okay, this is what we do," she said, outlining her plan. Nobody on board seemed either aware or bothered about the creatures that were attacking us, and no amount of Vaska and the rest of us hectoring them would change that. But why did we have to stay here? Vaska and her team had completed their mission, so surely we could leave. It seemed a sensible enough plan to me, but part of me had the feeling that it wouldn't work. It was too easy. Vaska decided to find the captain, assuming she wasn't amongst the casualties or those taken, and convince her to get the train moving. She deployed her small team in patrolling the outside of the train, with strict orders that if any more of the creatures were sighted, they were to raise the alarm and withdraw. Vaska reasoned that it was essential none of us succumb to the strange influence of the creatures. I didn't ask what my task was, and Vaska barely acknowledged my existence. I think her feelings were that I would just get in the way. She was probably right. I spent the next 5 minutes wondering what I should do. Most of my ideas involved me drinking a large amount of alcohol, but I suspected this would incur Vaska's displeasure. Without alcohol to lean on, I turned to one of my other support mechanisms, psychiatry. I made my way through the train, passing numerous people oblivious to the dire situation, and eventually found a trained psychiatrist, Dr. Bernadette Juncker. Dr. Juncker wasn't just a psychiatrist, he was my psychiatrist, who I had been seeing a couple of times a week for as long as I'd been on the train. Accessing psychological help is extremely difficult in the post-apocalyptic world. In many places, people don't have access to electricity, so mental health is pushed down the list of priorities. It was one of the many fringe benefits to being on board the train. I found Dr. Juncker in her carriage, and like so many of the others, she was in a flurry of activity. Dr. Juncker had two large chalkboards in her carriage, which she had covered in her neat, precise handwriting. "Dr. Juncker?" I asked. She looked over her shoulder at me and then went back to her work. "Hello, Richard. Did we have an appointment?" she asked. I explained that we didn't, but that as I was having a hard time, I came to see if she was free. I'm sorry, but not really. I'm working on something here. I looked at what Dr. Juncker was writing. It was in German, but fortunately I know a little German. Being a refugee very much encourages you to learn other languages. Abwehr Mechanismus. I read the unfamiliar word aloud in my dreadful German. The next word I recognised. Freud. Like Sigmund Freud. Yes, Sigmund Freud, replied Dr. Juncker. She pointed to one of the words. Denial. Then another. Repression. Then another. Sublimation. She then pointed towards the word I had spoken out loud. Defence mechanisms. What is it that you're working on, Doctor? I asked, as it suddenly seemed it might be relevant to what was going on. She explained in detail. As well as being a trained psychiatrist, Dr. Juncker did as much research as possible. The apocalypse had thrown up all manner of new psychological problems, and they would need to be investigated and treated. I often arrived for one of my appointments to find Dr. Juncker deep in work on some new condition, a homemade port of textbooks blocking me getting near her. Dr. Juncker often joked that her work was what got her through the apocalypse. Something terrible happened and she buried herself in work. It was a defense mechanism. All of us use defense mechanisms all the time. Denial, repression, sublimation, projection. All these are mechanisms to help us cope with the world. Dr. Juncker went on to tell me about these fascinating creatures who she had encountered, who had the ability to hide themselves in people's defense mechanisms. The creatures were exceptionally dangerous predators, and once exposed to their unique abilities, people were no longer able to fight them, or really to even notice them. Each individual used their most powerful defense mechanism, or a number of defense mechanisms. So some used denial and refused to admit the creatures existed. Some used repression, actually forgetting about the creatures entirely. For some, it was sublimation, where their fears and anxieties about the creatures were funneled into socially acceptable behaviours, like working. There's more, arguably dozens, depending on who you ask. Dr. Juncker had observed these creatures firsthand and their effects on the rest of the crew and passengers. Ever since then, she had been working constantly, figuring out everything she could about the creatures. It had become abundantly clear that Dr. Juncker was suffering from the creature's influence just as much as anyone else. It was just her defense mechanism was to work, and this was her area of expertise. She failed to acknowledge any danger that she or the rest of the crew were in, and couldn't understand my concern. I gave up on trying to make her see sense, and asked the most pertinent question. So, is there a cure? Dr. Juncker looked confused, so I elaborated. Is there a way to fix the memory of those affected? Is it possible to wake people up from their defense mechanism addled mind? Is there a way to fight the creatures? Dr. Juncker explained to me patiently, as one would to a small child, that no, there was no cure, no way to reverse the effects of the creatures, and she could not even begin to think of a defense against them. A large group of people under the creature's influence would most likely wait to be devoured, not fighting or fleeing, blissfully unaware of the terrible fate ahead of them. I left Dr. Juncker and went looking for Vaska. I found her arguing with one of the engineers about why he had decided to take the engine to pieces at this inopportune time. I was about to relay to her Dr. Juncker's work from outside of the train. A single shot was fired. Vaska rushed to the window. There's dozens of them, she yelled. I felt very afraid, while the engineer smiled in benign good humour. Dozens of what? He asked. Vaska gave up on the engineer and picked up her rifle. She pulled a small pistol out of her jacket and held it out to me. I don't like guns, was all I managed to say. Vaska did not seem pleased, but pocketed the gun and stepped off the train, her rifle in her hands. I ran to the window and could see the creature slowly advancing from every direction. Vaska rallied her team and they formed into two lines and opened fire. This worked for a few minutes, and at least 30 of the creatures were shot before something curious happened. One of Vaska's team, Kate I think her name was, lowered her gun and walked away from the line and strolled back to the train. Moments later, another two followed suit, while Vaska shouted at them to come back. with only a handful of people still listening to her, Vasta ordered a retreat and ran back towards the train. Some of the creatures followed her, but I became more concerned with the ones that were heading towards me. For a few seconds, I frantically tried to think of an escape. And then I realized what I really needed to do was work on the podcast. Dealing with the creatures could wait. And really, they weren't my problem. That wasn't my job. Something for the captain to worry about. Or Vasca, maybe. I'm here to make a travel podcast, not to fight monsters. I left and hurried back to my own carriage and quickly set up my equipment. My assistant, young Knox, was more than happy to help, and for once was really putting his back into the work. And that brings us more or less up to the present. I am really pleased with the podcast, and will get it online as soon as possible. Then it's starting work on the next podcast. I've got a lot of new ideas for it. That pretty much ends our story for this week, fellow survivors. Until next time, I'm Richard Oliver, and this has been a rail tour of post-apocalyptic England. At the End of the Line was written and recorded by Richard Oliver. If you like the show, please subscribe and rate on iTunes. Follow the show on Twitter at @PostApocPodcast. Anyone wanting to submit questions, ask for advice, or make urgent pleas for help should tweet us or send an email to @theendoftheline_podcast@gmail.com.
Today's advice is,
you really need to think more long term about these things, like maybe 28 years later.